The following is a presentation of thepublicrecord.ca.
We're live here at the George Hamilton Pub at Bay and King Street for a discussion on Hamilton's low voter turnout. The voter turnout this election was approximately 34% of registered voters, which is the lowest that we've had in Hamilton. So the question is, what should we, if anything, do about it? Joining us now is our panel here. We have Professor Alex Sevenier of McMaster University Communications, Elizabeth McGuire, who's involved in numerous community initiatives, amongst them COPE and the Campaign for Adequate Welfare and Benefits, or did I get that wrong?
Disability Benefits.
Disability Benefits. Elizabeth comes to us with a lot of experience from grassroots voter mobilization. And at the end, Professor of Marketing at McMaster University, Marvin Ryder. So I first would like to give each of you the opportunity to introduce yourself and answer the question. Is Is low voter turnout a problem that we need to address, and does it undermine the legitimacy of democracy? So introduce yourself and then answer that to start our discussion.
You want me to go first? Well, I think it's a concern that my memory of this goes back to the amalgamation of the city in the year 2000, where we did get voter turnout in the range of around 42% at that time. But that was a big ticket item. I mean, here we were talking about people voting together in the first time as an amalgamated city. And we've seen voter turnout just continually erode since then, now down to 34%. It's a concern, but it's not necessarily a Hamilton concern. Burlington's numbers are not good. Milton's numbers are not good. Oakville's numbers weren't good. Even Mississauga, with a replacement of Hazel McCallion's, numbers weren't good. Only Toronto had it. I can call that the Rob Ford factor, that there were people who maybe felt they had made an error not participating the first time around, now didn't want that to happen twice. But I think we'd love to see more. And the last thing I'd mention is that with Nathan Cirillo passing away just days before this election, I thought this would remind people about a civic duty and why we are a democracy, what have you, and it had no impact on people at all. So that's kind of sad.
Thank you, Marvin. Elizabeth?
Yes, well, we have seen that in the provincial election, we had a lot of support to do voter engagement. But for the municipal election, I mean, we just could not get volunteers together to go out and help. So it's not just voter turnout. We also saw a low response to the UN initiative when we were on the corners, you know, chew on this, sign the card for a national poverty strategy and get an apple in return. Even that was harder to sell to the population. There's just a malaise that just, it's so hard to address.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Alex?
You know, I think voter turnout has a lot to do with voters finding that there's a compelling story that they're being sold or told by candidates and by parties, if it's federally. Municipally, it's by candidates. I think it's been a long time since there's been a well-packaged, compelling, engaging, vital-feeling campaign that would drive people to the polls. I mean, you talk about the Ford effect, but actually, it was a compelling election in which you had three very different and well-defined agendas that were going forward, and we just didn't see that in Hamilton.
Some further thoughts on this? Let's have just an open discussion.
I think that's certainly true. What I'm worried about is whether we're seeing a disengagement of the citizenry in all levels. So even the provincial election this year, I believe the turnout provincially in June was only around 50%, 51%. Certainly just barely a majority of people voting, or it was high 40s. We're going to see a federal election in 2015, and I'm betting the numbers still won't be that great there, that we've got a group of the population who, for whatever reason, don't feel engaged in the process. They don't buy into what's going on. The arguments I've heard is they don't feel they are being, their concerns are being represented by the parties. But then having said that to you, I also find many citizens hold one example up. Well, since they don't agree with your stance on pipelines, then you don't represent me at all. Well, that's only one small part of what federal government does, or say municipally, snow removal, that's only one small part of it. You can still engage on these others. And so I'm not sure if we've set, as a citizen, the wrong benchmark for what engagement means.
Mm-hmm. I think it's tempting to say there's been a polarization of voters with the inequality economically is now translating into a polarization of those who vote and those who don't. It's tempting to say that, but We've seen voter turnout drop amongst all the economic sectors. So it's not just the poor, it's not just the rich who are disenchanted. I think overall we're more disengaged than we'd ever been.
So we've covered one of my next questions, so moving on. Do we want to increase voter turnout? Because there's some people are arguing that it doesn't matter what voter turnout is, as long as we're getting informed voters. And there's a risk that if, for example, we went to mandatory voting, that people would vote because they don't want to be fined, but would just randomly pick a name on the ballot. So the question being, and I think that amongst the people here, we all believe that voter turnout is good and civic engagement is good. So I'll actually advance it. Firstly, do you think that it's important to have voter turnout? And then if so, what do we do? Whose responsibility is it to get voters out to the polls?
Let's just go back to your first question for a second. This is a bit like I teach marketing, and I say advertising for the sake of advertising is a waste of money. You need to have a message, and I think voting just because you voted, if you're not an informed voter and you're randomly putting X's on a piece of paper, I'd rather not have you participate in the process. I'd like to have people who have at least weighed some issues and have some kind of an informed choice. And once again, while I'd like to see more engaged citizens, this comes back to then why are these citizens not getting engaged? And then you say, whose responsibility is it? I'm going to advance a thought here, and I hope this doesn't sound like a Luddite here, but I'm wondering to what extent multiculturalism can be connected to this. You talked about the economic side of this, but as Canada has become a more multicultural nation, and we have people coming to us from cultures around the world, whether they're Arabic cultures or Oriental cultures or parts of the former Soviet Union, in those cultures, voting is not taught to you at an early age. In fact, you know, there's only one party to vote in some cases. There's a dictator. You'd rather not show up. You know, those kinds of things. I'm wondering if we're seeing some of this reflected that the new Canadians from your different cultures, we're not explaining to them enough about what democracy means and why they need to be engaged. So to your question, who's got responsibility for this, I don't want to blame government, but I am thinking education. Maybe we need to have some further education in the elementary or secondary schools for new Canadians, maybe also as part of the process of becoming a new Canadian, to say this is a key responsibility that you really need to take seriously.
I like that, and we'll follow that up with a separate question about citizenship, and should we look at, for municipal elections, not having citizenship as a requirement but residency. But let's go back to whose responsibility is it to increase voter turnout.
Well, because I work with people who are on the lowest rung of the economic ladder, we took it upon ourselves to get our brothers and sisters out for the provincial election, and it worked well. We had higher voter turnout. We engaged them at the door. And to your point, actually, we found that those who are new Canadians were more engaged, were more attuned to the opportunity, lamented that they were just landed, but next year they would be fully fledged Canadians and they would vote, that this was important work we were doing. They were congratulatory and involved and engaged already, more so than people who were here. So who is responsible for engaging them? I don't know the right answer. At one point, we used to have the politicians go out and not only sign up people to register them, but also sell them a bill of goods. This is what I stand for. And people would rally around that politician, who would then provide buses for the people to go to the polls and vote. But that has now gone by the wayside because it's just not socially acceptable.
We're now a bigger city, so the cost of getting all those buses, it's an additional cost or touching. I heard complaints that no one's come knock on my door. Well, when you were a city of 200,000, that might have been possible. Now that we're 500,000, it's just not as easy to do.
Exactly. We had to focus our efforts, and we focused them on public housing, those who were in public housing, because that's where the low turnout is. And we think we had an impact. We'll know in a couple of months, as SPRC is looking at perhaps studying the impact we had on those specific polls that we did. It almost as if you have to say that invested groups, lobby groups, I don't mean lobbying companies, I mean neighborhood groups, that it falls to the neighborhood group, the neighborhood, the association of people in that community that have to encourage each other to get out and vote.
You know, I agree with you in the sense that we have to mobilize voters, but honestly, people do things because they feel that what they're going to do, made their choice, will matter. And that means that you need politicians who are representing specific populations and specific causes. You know, individual voters can actually say that if I vote for this person, I'm going to see a change in my life. And that's actually what we're not seeing. We talk about polarization in the voting public, or amongst, you know, the pundits on television or whatever. But actually, if you look at the three major parties, or if you look municipally, there's not a lot of differentiation between the three. They're very similar, right? So you don't really see, you kind of see three liberal parties right now, right? There are three different flavors of liberal. And then, municipally, you see, again, the same sort of thing. I mean, everybody's clustered around the center, right? So for me, one of the most powerful things you can do to mobilize people is to give them a very compelling story and to tell them that, you know, if you vote for me, you're going to see change, or I'll fight for you, right? And what we're seeing is because politicians are so concerned about reaching a broad reach of voters and having a message that speaks to everyone, you don't see these sort of great fiery champions anymore. I mean, the way you have done in the past. And if people don't feel that their vote doesn't matter, they won't vote.
You know, and if I can just play on that for half a second, we are still in one of the longest recovery periods in Canadian economic history. Our recession was relatively short. It only lasted 3 quarters, 9 months. It ended in 2009. Well, we're in 2014, and we're still in recovery. We haven't got to the top of the trough, so to speak. And what I think we're discovering in Canada, we have all the right fundamentals. We have low interest rates. We've got good monetary policy. We have clever people. We've got lots of cash. Companies are saying lots of cash. Our problem in Canada is because the rest of the world hasn't sorted itself out. Japan has just gone back in recession. Germany is back in recession, or not Germany, France is back in recession. We're waiting for the rest of the world to get going, and we've discovered we're not masters of our own domain. It doesn't matter if I elect a Liberal government or a Conservative government. That's not going to change. The same thing goes with the Ontario. We bemoan the state of the Ontario economy, but that requires other people to come, even in Hamilton. There is no politician I have met in Hamilton, whether they're running for office or an incumbent, who wouldn't want to see jobs. We all want more jobs. We all want better employment. But they've also discovered after many years with economic development, you can only do so much. You can roll out a welcome mat. You can't force companies to come here. And I think the electorate who wants an answer, they want a solution. I want jobs. I want it now. I want prosperity. I want, what are you going to do? Actually, I can't do any more than I'm doing. I need some other people to do things that I don't have any control over. I don't know if that's partly to blame here, too, for the disengagement issue.
So one of the great things about our format here is that we're not limited to 30 minutes. So I saw you were, I'm going to keep it short. I was concerned you're thinking, well, you know, it's like you have the earpiece that tells you, okay, 15 seconds and that's a wrap.
Yeah.
And I know both of you as professors are used to the television soundbite. Great thing about having this in a pub, the idea is meant to have that type of pub conversation. So we've touched on a lot of these issues, but I want to go a little bit more in depth on poverty and voter turnout, because in Hamilton, for the most part, poverty is one of the key factors that we can see. The lower income, the more poverty, the lower voter turnout. Now, one exception to that is the lowest voter turnout of any poll in 2010 across the province. And probably, I haven't looked at the numbers province-wide yet, but once again, the lowest voter turnout poll in all of Hamilton was 103, the one right around McMaster University. So let's focus on poverty, and then I want to actually come to that challenge of how do we engage students. So poverty, voter turnout, what can we do to assist those living in poverty to become engaged in the political process? I'll let Elizabeth start off because
that's your field.
Well, what we did was we had to get permission from City Housing to enter public housing buildings with the right kind of ID and that. And then we had to get guidance from the district returning officer to make sure that the information that we were handing out to people was actually accurate and approvable. So we found that the more information we had to give people, that we weren't there asking them to sign a document or to donate or to appear somewhere or to do anything other than here's a list of candidates running in this ward, here's the list of candidates running for mayor, here are the list of voting locations, this is a list of the information you need if you're on the voters list, and you call this number and see if you're on the voters list. If they say no, it's okay. You take this list of information with you and you can still vote. When they were engaged at the door, when you were giving them information they could use, voter turnout goes up. Some of the most unlikely people opened their doors to us. Now, on each floor, there were maybe 12 or 16 apartments, and maybe five opened their door. Of the five who opened their door, three wanted to be engaged, were happy to be engaged. One was upset with us and slammed the door, and one was a landed immigrant and wasn't able to vote yet. But those we contacted, those to whom we gave the information, they would engage in a dialogue at the door. And that was the turning point for me in terms of how to reach them, how to get them out. And we did end up with higher voter turnout in those polls anyway. At least we hope to be able to prove that.
You know, it's I think that what you're doing, very important work, and you're helping through personal sacrifice and in without any, you know, great agenda, bring people to the polls, right? Because mostly for their own benefit and for the benefit of enhancing social justice, right? But you're a tiny minority, right? The vast majority of political operations doesn't do anything for nothing, right? And it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, right? While you're doing God's work, you know, engaging the most destitute and the most forgotten, a beautiful thing. Most political parties are looking at who's most likely to vote and then targeting those populations, likely voters. And the very poor, the forgotten, the voiceless, the silent, they're very unlikely to vote. So outside of a small group of hardy people who believe very strongly that things must change and society must improve to have greater inclusion, these people are completely forgotten by the mainstream political parties and by mainstream municipal politicians as well, right? Because it's too hard, it's too expensive, it takes too much time, it takes too many volunteers to get out and do that work. But it goes back to this idea that I was saying earlier, that again, you can mobilize folks through a message that inspires them, that activates them. I mean, if you look at what happened in Toronto, one of the reasons that the Fords were so successful, right, both as councillors and then when Rob ran as mayor, is that they actually targeted those populations. You know,
but don't forget, Rob Ford spent 10 years answering every phone call that ever came to his office. I mean, he invested a lot of time and effort and blood and sweat and tears and his family into getting that Ford Nation built up.
Absolutely, and he overtly made himself the champion of the disenfranchised, the unrepresented, the alienated people, right? And because of that, you saw him ride a wave of popularity amongst immigrant populations, among people who suffer from poverty and exclusion, people who are ridiculed, people who live in very disadvantaged areas, right? But you know what he did? He told their story and he celebrated their voices. I mean, if you look at his campaign, when he won the Toronto mayoralty, it was a very simple campaign.
Yeah, stop the gravy train.
Right. Well, that was the mainline message. But I think what really got people to the polls was he actually went out and listened, right? And there were intense use of testimonials, etc. Now, I'm not saying that I endorse him or whatever, but what Rob Ford managed to do, which we haven't seen anybody do since Rob Ford, is really mobilize the armies of the disenfranchised.
Mm-hmm.
And Nobody's done it since.
So, Marvin, I want to actually expand a little bit on this theme that we're at, and this is one of the primary reasons I brought you on the panel, is what's the role of the municipality in increasing voter turnout? Because I remember in 2000, when you were chair of the Transition Board, which was charged with organizing that election, that the city of Hamilton had a voter engagement awareness campaign, that the new city of Hamilton, I have to remember it had the little squiggly new on everything, and you actually organized the mayoral debate. And for some background for those watching at home, the 2000 race had many mayoral candidates. There were four primary mayoral candidates that generated a lot of attention, and it was a toss-up. Nobody knew how it was going to work because we had nothing to go back on. And those four mayoral candidates, there was only three debates that all four of those mayoral candidates attended. The official City of Hamilton Transition Board debate, the Cable 14 debate, and the Grade 12 Glendale High School Civics debate. And for background, why they had that grade, they came out to the Grade 12 Civics debate, every student over 18 years of age at Glendale Secondary had submitted a voter registration form because there was a candidate that attended the school, happened to be me, Joey Coleman, and I made a point of, I'm going to get every one of those votes. But for the mayoral candidates, and this is getting that chicken or egg, they were excited at the opportunity of going in a room with 150 undecided voters. But so I want to bring it to, what's the role of the municipality, and can the municipality help with engaging people in poverty?
I'm going to split your question into two parts if I can. So a transition board story, if I can. In the year 2000, the transition board accounted for the single largest volume of column inches of text in the Hamilton Spectator. We were by far the biggest story in Hamilton that year. You couldn't pick up a newspaper week to week if there wasn't a story about the transition board. In September, early September of 2000, the QP local did a poll of citizens at large because they were seeing if there were some wedge issues they could use to help influence some of the issues they wanted to bring forward during the campaign. And a very simple question they asked was, are you aware that the cities are merging and this will be the first election of the merged city of Hamilton? And I will never forget that 50% of the people who they surveyed said, there's an amalgamation going on? We have no idea this is happening. And yet we accounted for more column inches than any other story. So, yes, I can be proud. I guess I can say we did get 42, 43% turnout. And thank you for saying it was because of this great voter engagement. But that's still less than half. That's still less than half of the people. And I could argue, go back to Alexander's point of view, or point earlier, that said we were at a crossroads. We were launching a new city. And this first mayor of the new city, there were some different visions. If you remember, John Monroe ran, and his campaign slogan was Return to Greatness. He wanted to go back. To go forward, we had to go back. We had Bob Morrill running, basically saying, stay the course. I've got you on the right path. I'm just going to expand my mandate. And then you had some others come in there. But at least we had a moment in history where this city was going to make, possibly going to change a direction in some way. You could engage people, I think, a little easier. Since then, it's very hard to come out with, elect me and I can do this. First, a mayor in a municipality is only a vote. So if you take an example, Fred Eisenberger got elected. He has said, you know, on the topic of LRT, he wants to form a citizens panel, have them review LRT. Well, that's lovely. What will the other 15 councillors have to say about this? It's quite possible Fred will bring this forward and he'll have campaigned on this. He'll have promised the electorate this is what he wants to have happen, and the first vote could go 1-14 against. No citizen panel, even though he promised it. So the ability of any one candidate to say, elect me and I will do. Now, if I can just give you another example in this election, we saw something we hadn't seen before. I was curious to see what impact this was. It wasn't at municipal council level, it was at the Board of Education level. We had two slates of candidates in the municipal board election voting. One was called, I think it was called the First 100 Days. I think there were six candidates for the Board of Education, and they had their plan. One of the big things was to freeze all school closures at least for a year and so on and so forth. From that slate, only one person got elected. There was another one called the Greater Schools Coalition. They were, in essence, against some, and I'm not stating their case well here, but they were against some sex education in the classrooms, some things about perhaps teaching that homosexuality is not a sin and what have you. And they had their candidates, and they put out actually a scorecard telling you which ones to vote. Only two of those candidates got elected. So here were two organizations, at least at this level in the Board of Education, who tried to mobilize by saying, well, if you elect our slate will have enough votes to make this happen. Citizens didn't buy into that model either. So it is hard to engage. I do think the municipality has to. I think we tried engagement in the schools. Again, I'll give you a silly example, but because this was the new city, I want to tell you it was grade 4. I could be out by a year. Maybe it was grade 3. We actually created a coloring book that was given to all of the schools about the city, and it talked about all the communities coming together. Here's something about Dundas and Ancaster, and we're coming together on January 1st, and this is what's going to happen. So we thought, well, maybe the kids would go home and tell Mom and Dad, hey, are you voting? Here's something important. So we did try things, but none of them worked out to be a silver bullet. All of them were relatively marginal and unproven, and I'm not sure we even gathered enough data to tell you which of any of them worked. So it's just, we have to, at all levels, I think, keep dripping away if we want to turn the tide.
And I realized I did not go back to the question of citizenship and voting. So right now I know a person who is a permanent resident who wants to join the library board. But because the provincial legislation requires citizenship to join the library board, and this person is a librarian, they can't join. So let's talk about engagement and citizenship. Do we need to relook at the municipal level how we regulate voting and being on committees as it relates to citizenship versus permanent residency?
Mm-hmm. If I can come at again your question slightly differently, so one of the things that, one of my sidelines, I guess I can call it, is I teach governance, corporate governance. And the big question today in corporate governance is trying to have boards of directors that are representative of the community at large, whether that be in terms of gender or ability or ethnicity or whatever it happens to be. And I've not met anyone on a board who wouldn't love more diversity, and they all say the same thing to me, it's very hard to find candidates. That doesn't mean that we don't have lots of people who represent these diverse communities, but generally they don't self-identify, and in some cases they don't feel it's their job to be part of it. I served on the hospital board. You'd be amazed the number of people I spoke to, so I'm not trying to argue your point, but you'd be amazed the number of people I spoke to who come from other countries, and I said, have you thought about serving on the hospital board? Your community could really use your input. And they said, well, isn't that a government thing? I want to get involved with a government thing. Well, no, not really. Yeah, well, where I come from, you know, this isn't what you do. You know, we help our own, so I'm part of the fill-in-the-blank society, say the Croatian society or the Senegal society, and we help our own, but in the hospital, we don't want to do that. And that's where said earlier, I'm wondering if somehow we're educating people that it's different here, and you got to play the game a little differently, and that rather than having barriers, we would welcome this diversity. We would love to have candidates, but they don't self-identify, and trying to find them is hard. So I'm beating a dead horse when I use education, but I really think somewhere in there, and it's not actually grade 2 and 3. Many of the students I teach at university came to Canada when they were 12 or 13, so they've only really, say, experienced high school. Oh, they're excellent at calculus and chemistry and physics, but some of that basic social studies stuff that we're taught earlier, they're lacking.
So, Marvin, to expand your point, do you think that maybe one of the barriers, though, is that when they're in the permanent residency phase and they're integrating with our society, there's that bar on participation of not yet having citizenship, so potentially they get into norms that are outside of that type of participation?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to try to engage every citizen in some way in this community. This is what Volunteer Hamilton is all about. Let's try to match the skill set to the opportunities. And if somebody really wants to serve in some committee, even if they weren't allowed for, say, the residency issue, there must be some way we can still engage them and get them involved. So I hear that. On the other hand, I don't know how you get rid of the rules. If the theory is, and I think why you're required to be a permanent resident, is sort of the tax dollars. We don't want people who don't have skin in the game, who are not contributing, to be controlling how that thing plays out. It would be like, I don't know, if I had somebody from Oakville serve on the Hamilton Police Board, well, why is that person who's not really paying into this telling us how to run things in Hamilton? So I imagine some of those are very good rules, and I'd be very careful tinkering with those.
Elizabeth?
Well, I can only speak from the economic strata of low-income people, and I do know a number of boards, whether they're corporate or social services or some initiative in the community, people are becoming more aware that people with lived experience have input. They have opinions, they have input. They had careers at some point, so they bring some knowledge to it. So they're being better recognized, even if they don't yet self-identify.
Well, I think it's a question of inviting people in. Sometimes it's a question of legislating. I mean, in Norway, for example, there I think 50% of board members have to be female, mm-hmm. right? And that at first caused a lot of dismay, but now is, I think, working out, right, it's, as far as I understand. Because it, when half of a corporate board or an organization's board is female, you see many different perspectives on what constitutes productivity, what constitutes, you know, successful integration into the workforce, et cetera. You know, so I mean, there's an example of where, you know, legislation was enacted that I think has made positive change. But municipally, I think that we really do a poor job of teaching citizenship, right? To me, the largest thing is to welcome people into the system and to tell them that they matter and that they have a voice. You know, and that it goes beyond, you know, just the United Nations Club at the high school, which all the, you know, preppy kids join, right? I mean, it's what you need is a ways of showing young people at from the youngest age to the end of high school that grassroots engagement via the real world or via the virtual world actually matters and that they can make change. And I mean, that's where, you know, actually having a civic engagement and civic participation be a part of the curriculum, I think, where, you know, young people actually do things in the community and see change is crucial. I was very fortunate to go to a high school in Newmarket where we had a large component of civic engagement through the Catholic school system. And it was, I think it led to many of us being believers in the Canadian political system, right? Because we actually saw that it's human, it's open. You can walk in the door, it's not a club, it's not closed. And that's that invitation, that welcoming perspective is what's lacking, I think, a lot of times in the party system and also municipally.
And I use two words I want to just reflect on for a second, voice and matters. Mm-hmm. So I think our municipal politicians, as an example, or municipal politics, gives people a lot of chance to give a voice. They can exercise their voice. Whether it matters is the other side of this. Now, I'll give you another bad example, so I'll be the evil man at the table, so to speak. In 2000, when we were creating the city of Hamilton, I asked for a list of all the committees that were going to exist in the new city of Hamilton, and it was an immense number. It was something like 163 committees that the city of Hamilton had. Now, some have municipal politicians on them. Some don't. It's just good, concerned citizens. And if you talk to many of the people who are members of those committees, oh, yes, we meet, and yes, we get to air our voice, and then we send a recommendation somewhere, and nothing ever seems to happen. And so some of those people were getting quite disillusioned. Now, what I had recommended was we dramatically reduce the number of committees, but then make them more responsive to council and have more council members on there so they can hear these concerns being raised and act on them. And okay, you can say, oh, it's going too far. I suggested we go from 160 to 16 and have them themed. So here's a committee on, let's say, poverty, or here's a committee, let's say, on student exchanges. We have, I think, at least 10 different committees that oversee student exchanges, but sometimes it's just one student. Why don't you have one committee that oversees 10 student exchanges? I don't think you have to have one for each. That went nowhere fast because, again, some of the citizens were upset that I was taking their little thing away from them. No, the kids for Kaga in Dundas, that's not the same as the Ancaster exchange to Sweden. No, how dare you? But my fear was that we were wearing some people out who, and Joey would know this as much as anybody, you see some citizens who are so engaged and so willing to share their voice, and yet after a while they get frustrated because no matter what they say, no matter what they do, nothing ever seems to happen.
Let me ask Elizabeth a question, right? I mean, you must every day hear stories. It's incredibly compelling stories of people who are excluded, people who feel as if their voice doesn't matter, or people who feel perhaps profoundly angry. I mean, I worked on a campaign in the 2008 election. I worked with Gerard Kennedy in Parkdale High Park, and we dealt with some very vulnerable populations. And what struck me most was that there was this hard edge to poverty, of course, right? And a side that was brutal, you know, that which these people's lives are being brutalized. But there was also another side which was profoundly human, profoundly compassionate, and had a poetry which, when you told it to other people, they would open up their compassion to these people who were excluded. So, I mean, who hears these stories in Hamilton, in your experience, would you say?
Basically, no one. There's nowhere to go when... So, to be on social assistance is to basically suffer every day, not just because of the low rates, but the oppressive nature of social assistance, how precarious your monthly check is. There are thousands of people in Hamilton who struggle terribly on a pittance. They're not getting enough to eat, and you know they don't have 2 cents to rub together, and the last thing on their mind is to go out and vote or to sit on a committee, for example. So they're tremendously disenfranchised, tremendously lonely. Some of them might find the campaign where they can come and tell their story and sometimes vent. And, you know, those of us who sit on that committee really stick together because we know we're all we've got against this tremendous oppressive nature of the system. There are so many heartbreaking stories that could be changed if we stopped the oppressiveness and started giving them enough to live on, such as a guaranteed annual income. That would have such a healing effect on people. We would be a happier people. We would contribute to our community. We'd probably vote more. Everyone all around would be happier and healthier, and you know, the economy would improve.
And those are, to me, those are human reasons for voting. They're emotional reasons. They're stories that we can relate to because we've all experienced loss and sadness and exclusion at one point, however privileged we've been. But you know, those stories don't get out. And I think, quite frankly, one of the greatest vehicles for voter turnout would be to start moving the system away from process and the big media themes, right? In terms of how you run municipal campaigns and tell the tell the story of citizens' lives, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's nothing more compelling. It's easy to vilify the poor and say, "Oh, we pay too much for social assistance," if you don't know anybody who's mm-hmm. poor or have right. not heard their story, mm-hmm. right?
And yet, you know what worries me a little bit here is the line of who's responsible for what blurs. Mm. So suppose I was a municipal politician, suppose I was running for mayor, and I said, elect me, and I'm going to have a guaranteed annual income for all citizens in the city. Oh, hooray, hallelujah. I actually don't have the authority to follow mm-hmm. through on this. And if I did, if city council did this, the fear is that if Hamilton was the first, then if you were a disadvantaged citizen in other parts of Ontario, mm-hmm. you might well want to relocate here to take advantage of this wonderful thing. So what started out to be a really good thing for the citizens, we attract other people who find that interesting, and because Toronto hasn't bothered, or Brampton hasn't bothered, or London hasn't bothered, we get those citizens, and then we've got more of a burden to carry. What we really need in some of these is a provincial solution. I've joked, I'll even go so far as to say this, I've joked that I don't think I'm ever going to take a political career, but I can't think of a more difficult political career than a municipal politician, because you are the closest to every citizen, and they'll bring every problem to you. And Hazel McCallion, who just stepped down as mayor, said the thing she had to learn to do in all her years was to say, that's not my problem. I know it's your problem, and I hear you, but I don't have an ability to affect that. You've got to take that to the provincial or the federal level. Although you see me at your doorstep and you see me in your community all the time, I can't take ownership to that. And sometimes I think, again, why people get frustrated with one level of government and others, they're taking the wrong problem to the wrong government. Now, fair enough, they might not know which one they should go to. All they know is they've got a problem, and you're a politician, here, help me.
Yeah.
But sometimes I think we ask too much. I had people, for instance, tell me in this municipal campaign that they were voting the way they did because they didn't like the reversal of Line 5, the pipeline. Well, no municipal politician can really do anything about that. Or I want to elect somebody who's going to do something about Canada Post and the door-to-door mail delivery.
Yeah.
Well, that's not a municipal responsibility. That's a federal decision. Mm-hmm. You've got an election next year where you can take that out on somebody. but this is the issue du jour, and therefore I want these politicians to do something. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think one thing we have to mention with this municipal election was the People's Platform, which came out of the Hamilton Civic League, which really tried to engage everyone in town on specific identified issues. So it took the work out of articulating what your particular issue was. You could vote on the various issues, and still we had low turnout.
Well, I don't mean to be a negative Nelly here, but that whole thing, and I thought it was lovely, well-intentioned by Norm Kerr, 300 people. 300 people were the people who put together the citizens' thing. It's not a lot of people for a city of this size. 500,000 people, that's less than 0.1%. There were evenings that they held to engage citizens in certain corners of our community where there were two people who turned out, and they were both councillors in waiting, running for election, who wanted to hear what the citizens had to say, and no citizens showed up to even participate. So was it really the citizens' panel? 300 people, but I doubt it was just truly random. So,
Marvin, you make a good point, right? I think another big problem is that there's a community of community organizers, right, in every city. And again, and I think social media and other ways that people interact now has actually intensified this problem. And the problem is the echo chamber. You know, conservatives talk to conservatives. People on the left talk to people on the left.
LRT supporters talk to LRT supporters.
Right, exactly, right? And as you say, you hold a town hall meeting, but because the conversation has been so intense among the people who already know something about what's going on, the rest of the population says, well, okay, it's a club I don't belong to, whether it's on the right or the left, right? And I mean, this is another challenge. It's this idea of public organizing, community organizing, actually turning into kind of an echo chamber.
So it's
a challenge for especially municipally, where people don't actually know what their city politicians can do for them.
So speaking of engagement and events, there was one mayoral debate that I'd estimate the crowd was probably about 450 to 500, and that's the Flamborough Chamber of Commerce debate at the Waterdown High School. It's a tradition. Everybody knows it's coming. Everybody looks for it, the campaigns look for it, and it's one of those debates that's guaranteed to have undecided voters. So during the campaign, I made a point of my outlet trying to cover as many races as possible. Never before have we had recording and even broadcast of trustee debates. And so throughout the campaign, dozens of debates I went to. The Flamborough one was the biggest. The Ward 13, hosted by the Dundas Chamber of Commerce for Council, was very well attended. From what I could tell on Twitter, the pictures and the tweets and the discussion, the Dundas Church's mayoral debate was very well attended, and it sounded like it was one of the more interesting ones where the candidates were forced off their speaking points.
I think it was also later in the campaign, too. So now some people who had polling results said, I better attack because my message isn't getting out. So you had a little more anger. Early debates, they were more friendly.
So I'm trying to take away from this, and a sense I'm getting is that we need to work on those organizations that can get people out. So the neighborhood associations, for example. I think our neighborhood associations are weak in many places of the city. For example, Ward 9. There was no Ward 9 council debate in Ward 9. And that was a seat that was open. So how do we empower that sort of grassroots and get out of the echo chamber is actually the question I think I'm asking now.
Well, if I could just dive in, I think the problem doesn't rest so much with the echo chamber, the community organizations, as it does with the voting system, right? The sort of first past the post model that we've used is fundamentally exclusionary and leads to the vast majority of people's votes, or could be the majority of people's voters' votes actually being worthless. Right, so I mean, a first step is moving towards a voting system, perhaps by preferential ballot or whatever, you know, which activates and operationalizes everybody's vote. Because I mean, one of the most compelling propositions is even if you vote for somebody who might not be a mainstream candidate, your vote will count because it'll get transferred up the tree of your preferences. Right. Right now we don't have that. Right now it's like you didn't vote for one of the top candidates, you're done. Your vote is useless, right? So, to me, that's the biggest step. I think the premier is taking some steps in that direction, but we have to see it as a concerted strategy across the province to change the way we vote.
Yeah, I'll say this. I'd love to see a pilot project somewhere to see if that changes turnout. Similarly, to give you a different version of what you're saying, would be online voting. Mm. Now, if I go back to poor people, they don't necessarily have access to the internet, and you know, that's a luxury, not a necessity, maybe that they don't have an internet connection. But to some other people who lead very busy lives, working lives, commuting, there are certainly people in Hamilton who leave here at 6:30 in the morning to go work someplace, come home by 8 o'clock at night, and the polls are still open for 15 minutes. They're exhausted. Would they vote online? I'd love to again see that. Now, Burlington, who did online voting, found an increase in the advance polls, which is where the online voting took place. But then they found a decrease on the day of the campaign. Fewer people turned out, and the overall percentage didn't change. So all online seemed to do there was shift when the vote took place. But I don't think we should throw the baby out with the bathwater in either of those examples. If this is a way in the world we live today, look, we have smartphone apps. I'm proud, if you'll say it, this to one of the contributions of the Transition Board. We were the first to move to an electronic election and got rid of X marks the box ballots. One advantage of that, by the way, was that when you put in a ballot, if it wasn't being read properly, the person could say, now you understand your ballot's not being read properly. If you wanted to spoil your ballot, you could say, damn right, I wanted to spoil, let that go through, and it would. They would say it was spoiled. But if you went, no, I didn't mean to do that, then you got to a second crack to fix it and put it in. I'm not just sure with preferential, now the reader is going to have to be more intelligent to make sure your one and your two and your three and your four are all noted but I'd like to see how that works. I'd like to see if the citizenry can get their mind around both of these, whether it's internet or the other. That might be a way to engage it. To Joey's point about community groups, some of this is a holdover from the world before amalgamation. So the communities that joined the city of Hamilton still have very strong identities. I live in Dundas, and Dundas is proudly Dundas. It's Dundas forever. Okay, they don't have a council, they don't have a mayor, but they're still Dundas forever, or Ancaster, or Flamborough. Most of those have very strong associations. Once you come to Hamilton, the associations don't operate on a ward level, they operate on a neighborhood level, and there are some neighborhoods. I can think of the Ainsleywood-Westdale neighborhood in Westdale is very strong. There's a neighborhood association in the north end of Hamilton, which is very strong. But if I'm on the mountain, I start to have problems figuring out where the neighborhoods are on the mountain because I don't really hear as much about them. So I don't know how we engender that. We've got BIAs, business improvement areas across the areas. They could be catalysts for some of this. But you're right. Either way we do it, there are some areas that don't have that, and thus maybe they need to be created to encourage the grassroots that way.
And I actually should, I just realized when you were talking about Ainsleywood, they were one of the first debates of the election, the Ward 1 debate, and well attended as well. And it's funny because by the end of the election, you start to forget about the beginning. So I failed to give them a shout out. So I didn't get tweeted at yet, but I'm sure that tomorrow I would have got the, hey, remember our debate? It was pretty big.
And just while you're there with Ainsleywood, that area, you mentioned this earlier, this is the McMaster University area. There are 26,000 students on the McMaster campus. Now, in fairness, some chunk of them, a significant chunk of them, commute. They live in Oakville, Mississauga. They come in by GO bus. I'm not sure how many people even realize McMaster is home to a GO station, a parallel GO station, which is an endpoint to the system. I can remember Marvin Kaplan in the old city saying, if I could just get 10% of the students to vote for me, get off the duff, and they would be allowed to vote because they're residents in the area, I could win this election hands down. And no matter what, and I've seen candidates, I've been at McMaster a long time now, 30 years, I've seen candidates try to motivate students, and the students, again, seem to have willful blindness to what's going on, and they don't feel it's about them. I think it's because they view their citizenry in Hamilton is only temporary. I'm only here for a few years. I don't think I even want to vote. I'll be electing somebody. By the time they do something, I'm going to be gone. But this question about engaging students, whether it's there or Mohawk, I will note that the high schools in Hamilton, they attempted to engage. And you may remember there was a famous story that in this one high school, they elected for Mayor Ejaz Butt. And I'm wondering to what extent they, if I can say, elected Ejaz Butt, or just people thought it was great fun to vote for Butt. And is that helping our citizenry? I don't know. But at least there was some attempt to engage them.
So I actually want to note that you're probably correct about the transitory nature, because my entire life I've voted in every election I could vote in except one. And that was when I was at the University of Manitoba. 3 weeks into my residency there, they had a mayoral by-election. And I said I had no idea who I was voting for or why, so I didn't vote. So I'm guilty of being...
Well, maybe you did us a favor, because if you're an uneducated voter, maybe it didn't help.
So we're going to do three more questions and bring it to a wrap.
There is another 15 minutes of audio from this discussion in the second part of our podcast, which can be found at thepublicrecord.ca. The Public Record is made possible by you. If you are not yet a supporter, please visit our website to learn how you can become one and to learn about future discussion events. This has been a presentation of The Public Record. Thank you for listening.